is at fault when a police officer shoots a civilian? Just ahead, a complicated picture into the issue as a local author and officer shares his research. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We're always live at 9. Make sure to subscribe to the Daily Podcast on iTunes and Stitcher and watch the show video on demand with our partners, TVJax.com. Just ahead, we speak with police detective and author Nick Selby on the police shootings of unarmed civilians. What he says the data shows. Get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, it's new clinical trials here on the First Coast for stroke patients as we mark National Stroke Awareness Month. Plus, a look ahead to the 2016 EVE Awards and this weekend's Craft Beer Festival. All of that coming up. But first this hour, it's a provocative new look at the killings of unarmed civilians by police, and it comes courtesy of a police detective. Nick Selby has spent decades on the force, and he also makes software technology for law enforcement. This month, he's out with a new book, taking an in-depth look into this hot topic, asking the questions, are police being fair? Are they targeting African Americans? Do they treat people of color differently when a situation escalates, especially when the civilian is unarmed? The answers are not simple, and there's a lot to unpack in Selby's new book. It's called In Context, Understanding Police Killings of Unarmed Civilians. Nick Selby, good morning.
Hey, good morning.
And here's our question to callers. What are your thoughts about this topic when it comes to the police shootings of unarmed civilians? We want your calls. 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email, tweet the show, weigh in on Facebook. So you decided to approach this topic from the perspective of an officer. You are on the force, and you also are a technology and data guy. What prompted you to sort of delve into the data?
Well, we were looking at the fact that when we read stories in the media, when we hear stories, when we see them on television, what we see is a very, very quick take about a terrible moment, the worst moment in several people's lives. And we weren't really getting a lot of context about why. Why were the police there in the first place? How did this incident unfold? Did the officer try to use non-deadly force before deadly force? Was the officer under attack? A lot of these kinds of questions don't really get discussed. It sort of gets added up as yet another in what seems like an endless series of you know, giant, never-ending headcount.
Right. And certain high-profile cases have not only generated outrage, debate, and frankly, division in this country, they've generated a lot of publicity. Names of like Freddie Gray, Michael Brown, others, where an African American and a police officer interact and the civilian can wind up dead. The Black Lives Matter movement has arisen in part out of this phenomenon. You decided to look at some data. Where did you find the data on all of these incidents?
Well, you know, that's, and what you say is exactly right. People are asking the right questions. You know, are we being treated fairly? Are we being treated unfairly? And unfortunately, both sides, the media, the police, and the activists themselves seem to be acting from a standpoint of emotion, not a standpoint of data. So we said, well, what would the data look like? And what we came up with was 79 different questions that one could ask about each incident. Things like, you know, where did it happen? What time did it happen? But also, was the person mentally ill? Or do we know that they were mentally ill? Or was there actually a prior diagnosis of it? Or did they just seem a little bit crazy? When we start to ask a lot of these questions, were people on drugs? Were they attacking somebody at the time? Did the officer have any previous history of violence or excessive force? That's when we can start to get into some context around each incident.
And as you look at this data in context, what are some of your key findings?
I think the most important ones that are really tied is, the first is, police are and have been terrible at sharing information and being transparent about almost all of these incidents. We are, as a group, we tend to be closed-mouthed, and that's not helping. When we don't release information about officer-involved killings, people fill in the blanks. The media fills in the blanks, and often the story is even worse than it would be if we simply told the truth. So that's a very important thing. We need to release more information, and we need to release it more rapidly. I think the second one is, when we were looking at the biggest predictors, what we found, it wasn't about race. It was actually about mental illness and drugs and poverty. Those are the predictors. Those are the things. And in matter of fact, in 46% of the cases in which an unarmed civilian ended up dead after an encounter with police, they were either mentally ill or suffering from acute narcotic intoxication or both. That's a huge number.
Almost 50%.
Yeah. And I mean, just to give you a sense, 31% of the people who were arrested last year were women. So it's, I mean, that's a very, very big group, people who are mentally ill or on drugs.
We're going to go to your calls a little early, only because I think I anticipate a lot of calls on this topic. It's author and police officer and detective Nick Selby. What are your questions for him as he looks at the phenomenon of police shootings, unarmed civilians? The book is called In Context. What are your thoughts right now? It's 549-2937 to join the conversation right now on this show. Let's begin with Cameron in St. Augustine. Hi, Cameron. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
It's funny. He actually just touched on exactly what my comment and question was going to be. Just, you know, that I've noticed, not that race isn't a big part of it, because the more you look across the nation, you do see that race is a part of it. But I've found it has more to do with, you know, cops that are on power trips. And I've met plenty of great cops, especially in this town, and plenty of ones that are just seem to be on a power trip. And I was wondering if you had any comments about the relation between federal funding for a local police station based on the numbers of people they bring in. And so if that touches on whether or not people are ready to make more arrests they probably shouldn't have to get more funding from the federal government. Thank you. I'll take my answer off here. Have a great day.
Thank you, Cameron.
Thanks. That's a really interesting question. So that sort of implies that there is a relationship between numbers of arrests and federal funding, which doesn't directly exist in the way that you might be saying. And I do agree that there have been, and especially in the 153 cases we look at, there have been a number of cases in which the officers were, in fact, from the standpoint of, you know, our analysis, unjustified. The number actually was smaller than you might think. But the idea of sort of tying police funding to arrests, that's not really the case. I think that where we do need more police funding and better police funding is in the area of true community policing. To do true community policing, it has to be an actual discussion, a dialogue, bidirectional communication. To do that, we actually need this kind of data, not just my project, but others like it, so that we can actually understand what does the community really care about, and are the police meeting the needs and concerns of those in the community?
You also make the case that police agencies around the country need more training in dealing with those who are suffering from some mental health issue.
Yeah, we really do. Most police agencies have a very small minority of officers who are actually trained as mental health officers. I'm not suggesting for one second that we need officers to be psychiatrists, but when 4.5 out of 10 people that we come across in terms of deadly force encounters have a mental illness or you know, drug intoxication, and usually it's both, what we need is better training on how to de-escalate, how to back off. And cops really do need some better training in actually retreating and letting time go by.
You know, just the other night, I was at the Ripple Effect Mental Health Awards that were held here, right here in the WJCT studios, and we got an education into recent efforts to look at those issues right here in Duval County, and we continue to cover those issues as much as we can here on this program. And right now, we are taking your calls as author and officer Nick Selby discusses police shootings of unarmed civilians in his new book, In Context. Otis in Jacksonville. Hi, Otis. How are you?
Hello, I'm just fine.
Go ahead.
Okay, I have two questions. I think a lot of times the shooting comes from a code of silence where the policemen always never tell on each other, and they allow criminal acts to take place amongst themselves. Also, I think the data is only good, the input that you put in is only as good as the individuals doing the typing. Because they sit together and they get together and they'll get their story together. Now you put in an incident and this is what occurred. But a lot of times cops are looking at each other and say, I got your back. And innocent people get killed, but I do think 90% of most of the police are great guys.
Well, thanks, Otis.
Thanks, Otis. Yeah. So, okay.
Yeah, those
he brought
great.
Up what people know as the thin blue line.
Sure.
You know, circling the wagons if an officer did perhaps make a poor judgment call or has implicit racial bias that ends up in a deadly shooting. What about his comments?
These are both great comments. let me take the second one first. Our data, you're right, the data is only good as those who are typing it in. We put together a panel of people that is people in law enforcement, but also we have people who have identified themselves as anarchists. We have a convicted felon. We have a transgender activist. We have data scientists who are not even aware that there's a presidential election going on. So we've tried very hard to make the data inclusive. You are welcome to go on to streetcredsoftware.com/PKIC and download the data yourself. And you can actually do any kind of analysis that you want. We encourage it. So the data, the only way that you can be sure that data is good is if the data is open. Our data is open and you have the right to go out and use it. Secondly, when it comes to the thin blue line concept, there have been cases of this. There's also been, I would think it's more interesting when officers lie. We recently had a case in Los Angeles, California, where Chief Beck recommended prosecution for the first time in his tenure as chief against an officer, not necessarily for what he did, but for the fact that he lied about it. I will say this. As a police officer who has personally arrested another police officer for a crime and had my entire agency and my chief stand next to me at the trial, I would ask you whether your opinion there is based truly on experience or whether it's based on basically television and film. Because in my experience, when I arrested another officer, I had the total support of everyone in my department.
Chuck at the Beaches. Go ahead, Chuck.
Hi, guys. I want to talk to your gentleman about a couple of things. You mentioned the term to de-escalate. I've studied self-defense for a long time, and that's the key word, to de-escalate, which is extremely important. But I also want to talk about, I'll use one, I think it's PTSD. How does a police officer deal with things every day when he sees people die from gunshot wounds? And he's in the situation he doesn't want to die from a gunshot wound, or because maybe he's seen this happen, he doesn't want to hurt someone who's a gunshot wound. And I'll throw a couple of terms out there that you may be familiar with. Ability, opportunity, intent, justifiable homicide, jury of your peers, and disparity of force. And by disparity of force, I mean when you have a police officer who may weigh 180 pounds, and then you have a young man who weighs 290 pounds and grabs the police officer's handgun, what position is the police officer in and how does he defend himself?
Yeah, thanks for those comments, Chuck.
Wow, great. Yeah. I mean, really, you know, a lot of things is with the military, and Clint Bruce actually says this in the afterword to the book, with the military, there are sort of intensive actions followed by periods of study. Law enforcement doesn't have that. We have no time to stop. Everything goes on every day. PTSD and stress among police officers is a truly, truly terrible problem that really needs to be addressed, especially mental health of officers who have been in these kinds of deadly force encounters. The kind of disparity that you're talking about, that actually came up in one of the cases, not when somebody grabbed a gun, but there was a man named Philemoni Rayawa in San Francisco who was 6'4" and 265 pounds, and he took two female officers and beat one of them almost unconscious, threw another one across the street. He ended up dying of a heart attack. This is a very common scenario in which someone is having an acute mental health episode, and they find themselves in a position where they have really, really disproportionate force over the officer. And the officers, in many cases, try non-deadly force, but ultimately end up using deadly force. We see this over and over again. And actually, it's not just our analysis. The Washington Post, in their analysis, they found that 9 in 10 of the police shootings last year that they tracked turned out to be fully justified, that the person who died was in the midst of a deadly attack at the time that they encountered the officers.
And to be clear, your findings also show, here's a little more context, video only available in 25% of cases. You're in favor of police body cameras.
Absolutely.
You also found your data shows 6.5% of police-involved killings of unarmed civilians unjustified. That's your data.
That's of the unarmed civilians last year. Our panel of three independently came up that with 10 cases that looked to us to be unjustified. I'll just make one comment about video. When we take a look at the fact that only 25% of incidents in which somebody died who was unarmed were captured on video, that means that 75% weren't. Here's another little statistic. Of the indictments last year, there were indictments of 15 officers in 8 different incidents. There was not a single indictment in a case that did not have video. That's a really interesting point, that there's 75% don't have video, and the only indictments we saw were cases where there were video. I've written in USA Today about the need to have more body-worn video, and I think it's really, really important.
Chloe, driving along somewhere. Hi, Chloe. Where are you today? Good morning.
Hi. I actually pulled off to the side on the highway because
Good move.
That's good. Our police officer approves. Hey, go ahead.
Rather than sorry. So my personal opinion growing up as a classical musician, you know, my family has taught me the ways and the rules of the land. I don't come off when you look at me as a black female. My little brother, on the other hand, he does look like a black male. The instance of Corey Jones, where in West Palm Beach, he decided to prevent any instance of that police brutality, to pull off on the side when his car broke down at 3 a.m. and not spend the night in a town he was not familiar with. Still got shot by a plainclothes officer in an undercover unmarked van, running away with his license to carry a gun on him. So, I mean, it's just instances like, what does the community, I know the officers on their part, but what is the community as far as the black community? We're angry, we're talking about it a lot. There's nothing to really teach our kids or even my younger brother. He's, you know, doesn't know what to do. He doesn't have a driver's license at 20 years old because he doesn't feel comfortable getting in a car. It goes that deep. And even another highway sheriff, I'm not going to mention the name or anything for anonymity, he actually told our family that he had pulled over a young white male with the intent to sell. And when he called for backup, because he had a large amount of cocaine on him, the student revealed that he was a medical school student, and the officer told him not to arrest him because it would ruin his future. So, you know, and that kind of drew some perspective for that officer, the one who had the intent to arrest, because he said, I've arrested many of my own people with no question asked for small amounts of marijuana or some other drug, and this guy had a lot of it. So it seems to operate more like a fraternity, in my opinion, and, you know, where everyone's looking out for one another. But where do the officers draw the line? How does the training happen? I know you said that you were there and arrested one of your fellow officers, but not everyone does that.
Yeah.
So I don't know, just some food for thought.
Thanks, Chloe. Thanks for sharing your family story. And, you know, other studies, and they're not necessarily police studies, Nick, but they show over and over again that white Americans have a subconscious bias in terms of seeing African Americans, particularly young African American men, as more likely to be threatening.
Yep.
And from that, what are your thoughts about her comments that those sort of unconscious biases can bleed into police encounters with especially young black men?
Yeah, they absolutely can. If you take a look at some of the more recent studies on this in a lab, and these are very, very difficult because I'm very skeptical of laboratory studies. But in labs, when they give sort of shoot, don't shoot tests to people, police officers most often do better than the general public. We're not actually looking, believe it or not, we're not looking at when we come into an encounter of when we know it's going to be a shoot, don't shoot. We're not looking at the color of your skin. We're looking at your hands. Police officers routinely do better at those shoot, don't shoot than untrained civilians who haven't been trained in use of force. Having said that, there's absolutely no way that I'm going to sit here and tell you that there is not inherent bias and implicit bias. That's absolutely not the case. I will say that about the case that she mentioned down in Florida, the issue of people with guns, we stayed away from that. And the reason that we did that, our book was designed and our research study was designed to gather the most likely to be unjustified cases. And the only way that we could do that was, look, most people in the community do not have an argument. If somebody points a gun at a cop or somebody else and a police officer shoots them, most people are like, hey, that's what they're supposed to do. If it's an unarmed person, that's when it looks bad. And so we only studied unarmed people.
Craig is in Arlington. Hi, Craig. What are your thoughts? Good morning.
Yeah, I'm old enough to remember when they started, conservative government defunding of mental health.
Great point.
In the country. And I witnessed this incident. It told me, every time I see one of these shootings, somebody, if they happened to be there with their cell phone, which, you know, like they didn't have when I saw the incident I saw, you know, that's the only reason we're talking about it is because of our technology today. But there was a bear in this little town in Pennsylvania, loose on the main street. There were two officers there, a wildlife officer and a police officer. The police officer had his gun out, and he wanted to shoot that animal. The wildlife officer had a dart, and they had a fight right there about that situation. I witnessed this. It ended up, the wildlife officer shot the bear with the dart, put the animal down, and they got the bear and took it out of town and released it. And I think it's a humanity problem. I think we have less humanity for human beings than we do for our animals. It's just striking to me. I always default to that incident I witnessed. So that's what my feelings are.
All right. Yeah, Craig, thank you for sharing that.
That's really interesting. I'll point this out, and I mentioned this in the book. First of all, when you say conservative, you know, it's funny, we covered this in the book. Actually, the push from the federal government to move mental health into the community actually started in the Kennedy administration. And in 1965, when Medicaid was introduced, what they were talking about really was the fact that the federal government shouldn't be in the business of mental health, that it really had to be a local issue. That got exacerbated under, certainly under Ronald Reagan, but even under Jimmy Carter and other presidents since. What we have right now is a dysfunctional mental health
system of care.
Yeah. And if you take a look right now in the St. John's County Jail, approximately 30% of the people in that jail right now are suffering from mental illness, often serious mental illness. That's a very important point, that police are the most obvious nexus of government and civilians. So oftentimes what ends up happening is that issues that should have been handled by the social safety net are not. And someone only comes into contact with the police when they are truly, truly in crisis. So that's important. Second, when I'm out on the street and I'm a detective now, I haven't been on patrol in a while, but when I've come across dogs, I was always the one who reached for my taser. I don't want to shoot a dog. On the other hand, my partners have always been the one to take out their gun because, you know what? They don't want to be mauled by a dog. It's a very, very common argument that you pointed out over that bear. Thanks a lot for that call.
A couple of tweets for you. Does the data show any differences between officers with a four-year degree versus those that don't?
What a wonderful question that we did not take into account at all. Thank you. We're going to put that into the update. That's a great idea.
Because, of course, now here in Jacksonville, for many years, JSO required a four-year degree,
yep.
and they've recently been reviewing that.
Yeah.
But let's go to Stephen at the beaches. Hi, Stephen.
Hello. Good morning.
Hey.
Go ahead.
Hey, I think your study is extremely valuable, and I was particularly struck by Cameron and Craig and the young woman's comments. The comment about the fraternity that atmosphere in police departments, to me, is a very telling comment. I understand policemen in Jacksonville say, with the amount of shootings and murders that we have in this town, I just admire them so much to be able to go out every day and be a policeman. But at the same time, anytime someone is killed and that has no arm on them or no firearm on their body, we have to look into that, and we have to look into it with transparency. Body cameras, thank you so much. And I think accountability boards, citizen boards, created with the substantial people and ex-law enforcement people in the community that examine incidences like that. We need that to open up transparency so we all can feel that our police are on our side.
Thanks, Stephen. That issue of an independent accountability board has come up here in Duval County over the years. What do you think?
I love it. I mean, I think it's great. I think that most of these problems with the community and law enforcement are solved by dialogue about the actual facts of the case. One of the things that we think is, and if anyone is listening who's involved with Black Lives Matter, we've actually reached out a couple of times. what I want is, what I see is, we have an unprecedented opportunity where people are really interested in this. This is the opportunity in my lifetime to truly change the way policing is done in this country. It is so much better. It feels good to yell, but it is so much better to actually debate facts, because when you do that and when you can let data and not the narrative drive that conversation, we will be able to make a difference. And so we are absolutely for anything that brings out facts. One point, Las Vegas, Nevada has a policy that all facts on every deadly force incident come out in the first 48 hours. Every single fact. What this does is it gets the community both invested and informed, but it also, every one of those times, is a deposit in the bank of goodwill. Every time they release information, citizens feel that the cops are leveling with them, and so now you have a basis for dialogue. And those few times when they say, hey, we need a few more days, there's trust because there's transparency.
It is certainly a very timely book, and one focusing on a topic with such great interest. The use of deadly force by police, and we so appreciate you being with us today to share your data and your thoughts with us. A great discussion. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me, Melissa. I really appreciate it.
He's police detective, data expert, and author Nick Selby, and the book is called In Context, Understanding Police Killings of Unarmed Civilians. It's out now. And much more still ahead. Later on the show, raise your glass to this weekend's big craft and import beer festival. We'll get a look at what's on tap, literally, for that. But up next, new clinical trials at Baptist Health, giving hope to sufferers of stroke. We're back in a moment.